When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to Crime Naps. I am Eileen.
And I'm Charlie.
We just want to start by thanking our patrons for their support, especially as we've been inactive for the last couple of months. So thank you, Tanya, Angela, Jubilee, Terry, Kelly, Ray, Sophie, Shannon, Emily, Dara, Tom, Mac, Gina, Emily, Alan, and Adam. We appreciate your support more than you'll know. This episode contains information which may be triggering for some listeners, relating to domestic abuse and coercive control. Listener discretion is advised. This episode was written and researched in part by Fern from Evidence of a Crime. All sources will be on our website, as will helpline numbers if you need them. If you are in immediate danger, please contact emergency services. On May 3rd, 2016, Margaret Hammond reported her daughter Natalie Hemming as a missing person in a 999 call. She was asked if there was anything that made her concerned, and she simply said, "Him." This is Dance with the Devil.
In 2007, Natalie went shopping at her local supermarket and bumped into a man named Paul Hemming. He was 11 years older than her, but that didn't bother Natalie. She thought he was attractive and charming. He had a good job, a nice house, and a nice car, and their brief encounter rapidly evolved into a relationship. Natalie began staying over at Paul's house with her daughter within weeks of meeting him, and by 6 months, she decided to move in. Natalie was besotted with Paul, but her family weren't so sure about him. Her sister Joanne had since spoken in an interview about the first time that she met Paul. She had expected him to be respectful and polite, given that she was Natalie's sister and they were meeting for the first time. But instead, Paul dismissed Joanne completely and announced that he had to go and get changed before disappearing upstairs. She described him as standoffish and odd. Margaret, Natalie's mum, also didn't have a good feeling about Paul, but she would be civil to him for Natalie's sake, because she knew how much Natalie loved him. Natalie Deborah Hammond was born on the 15th of July 1984. She had two sisters and two brothers. Her sisters say she would get away with everything as the baby of the family. Kerry was 5 when her sister Natalie was born, and as sisters do, Kerry, Joanne and Natalie bickered endlessly. But as the three of them grew up, they became extremely close and were always there for each other. At school, Natalie's favourite subjects were history and English, and she was regularly found with her head in a book. She was outspoken and loud, but equally a really nice, funny, caring, and genuine person. She loved buying shoes, clothes, and handbags, and was overall a fantastic mum, daughter, sister, and friend. After Natalie left school, she joined the Navy, where she met her first partner and went on to have a baby girl who they named Kirsty. Natalie loved being a mum, but like many new mothers, she struggled with postnatal depression. Her partner was still in the Navy and lived far away, so couldn't really help Natalie in those essential first few months. They both agreed that it wasn't working and decided to separate, and Natalie went on to raise Kirsty alone. That was until she met Paul. Matthew, Kirsty's father, said that he tried sending gifts to his daughter and seeing her, but Paul wouldn't allow it. 4 years into their relationship, Natalie had fallen pregnant with her and Paul's first child together, a little boy. And 3 years after that, they went on to have a little girl. From the outside looking in, the family of five seemed perfect. The reality was quite the opposite. Natalie's sister said that they were a large and close family. Paul didn't mix with them. At family gatherings, he always sat apart from the group and stayed quiet. He had even refused to attend his own children's baptisms, which resulted in temporary splits of their relationship. Natalie was very careful about what she told her family members about her relationship with Paul. And according to her sisters, they had no idea what was really happening inside of Natalie's home. They knew that Natalie and Paul would argue and that Natalie wasn't happy in the relationship, but the thought of domestic violence had never crossed their minds. In July of 2007, 6 months into his and Natalie's relationship, Natalie had filed a statement with the police detailing a violent incident that had occurred in their home. She claimed that her phone beeped and Paul grabbed it in anger. It was a message from her ex-boyfriend saying, "Happy birthday, honey. Take care of yourself." Paul read it and threw the phone at Natalie with force, where it struck her in the head. Immediately, she began to pour with blood, and she asked Paul to phone an ambulance or take her to A&E, but he said no. He then threw her on the bed, put his hand around her throat, and had tightened his grip. Eventually, he drove her to A&E in Hemel Hempstead, where he told Natalie that if she told anybody the truth, he would kill her. She writes, "I am really scared of this man," and signs the statement at the bottom. A few weeks later, in August, Natalie retracted her statement, claiming that she was doing so of her own free will and was working on her relationship with Paul. Natalie decided to take back her life. After raising her two babies and applied for a job at the Mercedes dealership, but Paul begged her to stay at home, even claiming that he would pay her to do so. On her own YouTube channel, Living With Murder, her sister Joanne claims that Natalie never had any money. She thought this was odd because Natalie worked and had a good income, but yet she was always reliant on other people buying her things if they went out. At one point, Natalie had gone away on holiday with Kerry, her other sister, and had taken barely anything to spend. Her best friend Becky also claims that Paul constantly made Natalie feel as though she'd done something bad, saying she didn't have a nice life with him. Natalie and Paul had agreed to get married, and Natalie had excitedly told all of her friends and family. She'd booked the venue and arranged the whole day. He even bought Natalie a £2,500 engagement ring. Paul later cancelled the whole event without even telling Natalie. He would continuously promise to get married to her and use this as a manipulative tactic to keep her around. Whenever the relationship was crumbling, Paul would reintroduce the idea of marriage. Eventually, Natalie changed her surname to his as a compromise. Natalie wasn't the only person who had faced abuse at the hands of Paul. During an interview with Natalie's eldest daughter, Kirsty, who was 12 at the time, she claimed that she had accidentally left an apple in her bag that had gone soggy. Paul, her stepdad, demanded that she clean out her bag and made her stand in the corner of the living room for 13 hours, overnight, before having to get dressed for school. She claims he went up to bed and repeatedly came down through the night to check that she was still stood upright in the corner, facing the wall. She was so frightened of him that she didn't take the chance of sitting down. Kirsty claims that he was angry on a daily basis, and that something as small as not tidying up or forgetting a piece of homework would result in her being forced to stand in the many naughty corners of the house, or being sent to bed without food. Natalie tried to sneak food up to her daughter, but if Paul found out, he'd become violent, so she wasn't always able to do so. Both Natalie and Kirsty were petrified of him. Paul's ex-partner had been emotionally abused and physically assaulted by him too. He had been controlling and aggressive from the beginning, but began to get physically violent around a year into their relationship. He spat in her face in front of all of her friends and said, "The only way you'll ever leave me is in your grave." He took her to a wooded area and repeatedly elbowed her in the face until he broke her nose, and then drove her home before forcing her to have sex with him, while she was scared for her life. If he was mad at her, he'd make her sleep on the floor naked, and if she turned around to look at him, he would kick her. Natalie told her family that Paul had two faces, the one he showed to everybody else and the one that she saw at home. In December 2013, Natalie decided she'd had enough, and she moved away from the home she shared with Paul in Milton Keynes to Yorkshire to live closer to her sister Joanne. Joanne did everything she could to assist Natalie in her move, and was so proud that Natalie was starting her life all over again. But despite moving miles away, Paul would not leave Natalie alone. He followed her to Yorkshire, and would show up randomly on weekends, claiming that he just wanted to see his children. Eventually, he began showing up every weekend, or through the week, until he managed to convince Natalie to move back in with him, under an array of false promises. Joanne was heartbroken upon finding out that Natalie was going back again, and had turned to her and said, "If you dance with the devil, you are going to get burned." Their relationship continued over the years, but it didn't take long for Natalie to realise that Paul was never going to change. She was completely fed up and extremely unhappy. Finally, in April 2016, she told her sisters that her and Paul had agreed to separate. She said it was completely amicable, and they were both looking for somewhere to live with the intention of renting out the property that they shared together. Natalie was looking forward to starting a new chapter in her life, and her sisters say that it was like a weight had been lifted off her shoulders. They could finally see the old Natalie again. Natalie and Paul continued to live together whilst they were in the process of separating, but as far as Natalie was aware, everything was over between her and Paul. She had begun to talk to a colleague of hers named Simon, who she was very fond of, and they would sit in the car on their dinner breaks, cuddling and having a coffee together. Her best friend Becky was extremely nervous about Natalie's new relationship, and had texted her telling her to be careful because she thought that Paul would react negatively when he found out. Natalie replied that it would be fine, because her and Paul were no longer together. Paul had no right to know, at that point, who Natalie was seeing, but Natalie told Paul anyway, out of transparency, given that they were still living together.
On the 30th of April 2016, Natalie dropped her kids off at her mum's house for an overnight stay while she went on her first date with Simon. Later that night, her youngest daughter, aged 3 at the time, was not settling, so Margaret rang Paul, who was home alone, to come and pick her up. When he arrived, he noticed that Natalie's car was still parked outside of Margaret's house, and asked Margaret what her car was doing there. Margaret told him that she got picked up and had gone out for a drink with her friends. On the morning of the 1st of May, Natalie was seen on CCTV leaving the hotel with Simon hand in hand with a huge smile across her face. The pair walk across the car park and kiss before fading out of sight. Simon then dropped Natalie back off at her mum's house before leaving. Natalie's mum had told her about Paul seeing the car the night before and told Natalie not to be frightened of telling him the truth about where she had been. Natalie left shortly afterwards. At around 1:30 p.m. she returned home to Paul. This was the last time she was seen alive. Margaret tried to call Natalie later that night and several more times over the following days, but there was no answer. On the 3rd of May, Margaret, overcome with worry, travelled with Natalie's cousin to the home she shared with Paul to see what was going on. Margaret and Natalie's cousin anxiously banged on the door, and they could see Paul, who they expected to be at work, through the window, avoiding them. Eventually he opened the door but did not invite them in, until Natalie's cousin pushed his way through, claiming he needed the toilet. He looked around for Natalie quickly, but she was nowhere to be seen. Margaret asked Paul where Natalie was, and he told her that she decided to go away with her friends for a few days to clear her head. Her cousin asked what without her car, but Paul dismissed it. Margaret left the home panicking about Natalie's well-being and called Natalie's sister Joanne to ask what she should do. She told Joanne that she hadn't heard from Natalie in 2 days, and Joanne urged her mother to phone the police, just to be on the safe side. At 4:06 p.m. on the 3rd of May, Margaret dialed 999 and reported her daughter missing. Joanne was also extremely worried about Natalie's well-being upon hearing this news. She knew that Natalie would have never taken off without telling any of her family, given how close they were, and she certainly wouldn't have left her children in the care of Paul. Joanne says that her stomach did a somersault and she had known almost immediately that something terrible had happened. She spent the whole evening feeling sick with worry and was extremely concerned for the children's safety too. Police officers conducted a welfare check on Natalie a few hours later, just after midnight on the 4th of May, and Paul's strange behaviour immediately began to arouse suspicion. The police officers asked Paul if they could have a look around the house to check that Natalie wasn't hiding anywhere, and Paul aggressively responded, "There are 3 kids in bed. When she wakes up, I'm not going to be able to talk to you because she'll cry. Can it not be done in the morning?" To which the officer responded, "We're looking for Natalie now. Is the torch going to disturb her?" While one officer conducted a search of the property, another questioned Paul about his relationship with Natalie, which Paul described as "all right." The officer then asked Paul if he was able to take his phone so they could conduct a data search, but Paul was unwilling to do this. He claimed that he'd bring his phone to the station the next morning because he was too worried that he'd miss a call from Natalie. After being unable to locate Natalie in the property and witnessing Paul's dismissive behaviour following the disappearance of the mother of his children, alarm bells began ringing for both officers in attendance. They decided to arrest Paul on suspicion of murder at his home that morning. Upon being arrested and cautioned, Paul turned to the officers and asked, "Have you found her then?" Following his arrest, Paul was led into an interview room where he began sobbing, asking for tissues and could barely contain himself. Just minutes later, he was fine and didn't appear upset at all. He gave an account of how Natalie returned home on Sunday, May 1st, with the children as he was making dinner. He said Natalie did not seem herself, so he began kissing her face and stroking her cheek in an attempt to be more sensitive. He asked her what was really wrong, and she said, "I didn't enjoy last night, something happened." When he asked her what, she told him that she was pressured into sex by her colleague, Simon. He stated that he asked her, "So you've been raped?" And she said yes. The interviewer asked Paul how this made him feel upon hearing that Natalie had been raped, and he said, "I felt I'd let her down." According to him, she then told Paul she needed to get away for a few days to clear her head, and he told her to take as much time for herself as she needed. Following this conversation, he went upstairs with the children at around 6:50 p.m, and when he got up the next morning, Natalie was gone. The police asked Paul to confirm that he definitely did not leave the house that night, and he confirmed he had spent the whole evening asleep. Natalie was listed as a high-risk missing person, given that this behaviour was completely out of character for her, and officers began to appeal for information of her whereabouts that same day. They quickly discovered that Natalie had not used her phone since 4:46 on May 1st, and her phone was manually turned off on the morning of the 2nd. Her bank account had not been used, and she hadn't contacted any of her family members, so the police's initial inquiries were focused around finding proof that she may still be alive. Paul's phone was also turned off on the evening of the 1st, so location data could not be analysed to determine where he had been.
The police were given access to WhatsApp messages by Simon, who'd spoken to Natalie and had sent her messages that evening. Natalie to Simon. 1st of May, 13:55 p.m. "Thank you so much, baby. That was the most amazing night I've ever had. You were gentle, kind, and caring, and that meant the world to me. 1358. I fell in love with you even more last night. 1421. My mum said thank you for getting me home in one piece. They spoke some more, and then Simon messaged later that night. Midnight. I'm guessing you fell asleep nice and early. I'm missing you like crazy. Just got into bed and I'm wishing you were in my arms. Keep thinking about last night and I just want to kiss you more. Night, babe. Then, on the 2nd of May, he said, at 10:10, are you okay? I just need to know that, then I'll leave you be. The last two messages were undelivered to Natalie's phone, indicating to the police that Natalie had been murdered prior to this, giving them a more specific time frame to focus on. As the investigation continued, Joanne and Kerry travelled to Hemel Hempstead, where Margaret, Natalie's mum, was living, to help look after the children who were staying with her. They say that those days were extremely long and difficult, and that all they could do was focus on keeping things as normal as possible for the sake of the children, who were completely unaware of what was going on. It didn't take long for the police to poke holes in Paul's story, because even though he claimed to have been home and asleep all evening, his Ford S-Max car had hit two cameras with automatic number plate recognition, one in Whitchurch in Aylesbury, around 18 miles from his home, on the 1st of May at 10:16 p.m, and again at 0006 in Aston Clinton, around 16 miles away, returning home. Paul had intentionally avoided any other ANPR cameras, which meant that he'd gone undetected for an hour and 50 minutes, leaving the police clueless as to where he could have been. Natalie and Paul's six-year-old son was then interviewed and unknowingly gave the police vital information. On the evening of the 1st of May, he says he was asleep and heard a noise that was really loud, like thunder, like three glasses smashing. He'd gone downstairs to see what it was and peeked through a gap in the door, where he thought that he'd seen a bowl or a pan of some sort with what looked like sick inside. Daddy was cleaning a wet patch on the floor, and Mummy was laying on the couch asleep, wrapped in a blanket. He then ran back upstairs to bed because he didn't want to be shouted at. He says that a big red rug on their living room floor was now gone, and had to be taken to Daddy's work for a wash because it had a wet patch on it. He then said that he hadn't seen his mum since, and that his dad had told him that she was sick. They asked Natalie's six-year-old son to draw a picture of the living room and the big red rug and where the wet patches were that Paul was cleaning up. By doing so, the crime scene examiners were able to focus more specific areas where they believed Natalie may have been killed. In the same area where Natalie's son had drawn the wet patches, forensic scientists found numerous airborne blood droplets on the side of the coffee table in the home. Paul's car was also examined, and spots of blood and red fibres from the rug were located inside. It was clear to police at this point, Natalie was no longer alive.
I'm able today to give an update on the search for a missing lady, Natalie Hemming. Natalie's been missing now since Sunday the 1st of May, and she was last seen just before 4 o'clock in Hemel Hempstead. In relation to that investigation, the man has now been charged with Natalie's murder. However, we are still searching for Natalie, and it's important that we do everything we can for her family in order to find her and return her to them. As part of that, I have 3 appeals today, as well as some new information. The first part of my appeal is, again, for anybody who has any information about Natalie that hasn't come forward to the police and spoken to us, to come forward and speak to us as soon as they can. The second part of the appeal today is around a black vehicle. This is a black Ford S-Max vehicle. We have that vehicle, but we're interested in where that vehicle was just before 10 p.m. on Sunday the 1st of May through to the early hours of Monday the 2nd of May, which was the bank holiday, just before 1 a.m. Again, we know that vehicle took a number of routes, both around Hemel Hempstead into Aylesbury and the southern side of Oxford. That vehicle is EJ12UWG. So again, anybody seen that vehicle, has seen it parked up and hasn't spoken to the police to come forward and speak to us. The third part of my appeal is for an item that's missing from Natalie's house. And you'll see a picture of that on the screen now. That's a large red rug. It's described as being between 12 foot long, 10 foot wide, and it has a medium depth pile. That is missing, and I think it's very, very much connected to her disappearance. So I'm looking for anybody who has seen that rug or a similar rug discarded, dumped, or in an unusual place, including anybody that's moved it, because if they have, that's fine. We just need to know where it is now to come forward and contact the police. And that's within this kind of geographical area, so Aylesbury, the top end of Oxford, up into Bedfordshire and Northamptonshire, to come forward and speak to us. We are conducting a number of searches in our bid to find Natalie. They will be ongoing, and anybody who has any concerns about those searches can speak to police officers who are present. There's two ways in which people can contact the police. One is on 101, a quoting reference number 1478, the second, the 4th of May, and the second is via Crime Stoppers, so people can leave information anonymously if they don't want to speak to a police officer. That's on 0800 555 111.
On the 6th of May at 9 a.m, the investigation changed from a missing persons investigation to a homicide investigation. The police interviewed numerous family members and friends of Natalie and Paul to build the case on what kind of person Paul truly was. Paul didn't have any friends. He was unsociable and had controlled every woman that he had ever been with. Many described his personality as Jekyll and Hyde. Paul had continued to be cooperative with police in interviews and would have an answer for everything they challenged him with. On the 6th of May, hours before his custody clock was due to run out, they presented him with the blood evidence they'd found in his living room. He claims that if they ever cut themselves, they flinch, which may have caused the airborne droplets. As soon as he's shown the images of his car being caught travelling on ANPR cameras, he stops cooperating immediately and continues the interview, stating, "No comment." The officer asked him where he believes Natalie to be, and he says, "I have no idea." Paul then says, he's also very concerned about Natalie and says he doesn't appear concerned because, in his heart, he knows she's not dead and can't make miracles happen. The officers then disclose their final theory to Paul, suggesting that he'd flown into a jealous rage and killed her after finding out about her date with Simon. Again, Paul denied any knowledge of Natalie's death, and the interview was drawn to a close. Despite the location of Natalie's body being unknown, the Crown Prosecution Service agreed to charge Paul Hemming with the murder of Natalie Hemming on the 6th of May 2016. When the officers read Paul his charges, he simply replied, "I'm not guilty." The superintendent on the case, Simon Steele, arranged a meeting with Natalie's family the following day. He advised them that it was unlikely they may ever find Natalie's body due to the search area being so vast, around almost 500 square miles. And he wanted to prepare them for the chance of a no-body conviction. Although no-body convictions occur, they are extremely rare and help to strengthen the defence in any murder trial. Joanne asked if it would be productive to write Paul a letter, asking him to disclose where Natalie's body was for the sake of the children. But Simon advised her that he didn't think it would make a difference. The family were devastated. They knew that Natalie had been killed, but they were desperate for closure of finding her body to be certain that she wasn't still out there, and also to give Natalie the dignity of a proper burial. Paul appears at the Crown Court on the 9th of May 2016 to be formally charged with the murder of Natalie Hemming. He did not make an application for bail, and his plea hearing was set for July 11th. Over the following weeks, the police increased their search efforts in an attempt to locate Natalie's body as quickly as possible before Paul's trial was due to go ahead. They knew that the longer it took to find her, the less evidence they were likely to recover. On May 12th, the police held a press conference and appealed for members of the public to come forward if they had any information about a large red rug. It was described as being 12 foot by 10 foot, with 3-inch soft pile. A woman in the area had witnessed a dark-coloured hatchback car, similar to Paul's car, with the boot open, parked on the side of a road. She'd seen a man walking around the disused railway track next to the car. The police searched the whole area on foot with the assistance of a police helicopter. They were unable to locate Natalie or any evidence to prove her or Paul had been there. The search team continued to trawl multiple wooded and secluded areas in many areas where Paul could have driven his car. On the 22nd of May, a man from Chandler's Cross was mowing a hedge beside his property when he encountered an awful smell. He glanced behind a cluster of trees, thinking a deer or another large animal may have died. And horrifyingly, he discovered a naked body lying face down in an overgrown ditch. In a panicked state, he called the police and alerted them to his discovery. Joe and Kerry were at home making Sunday lunch for the family when they both noticed they'd a missed call from the family liaison officers. They both looked at each other at the same time and said, "They found her." Natalie's body was taken for an autopsy immediately and identified via DNA confirmation. Her body had been left in an open wooded area for 3 weeks and was in an advanced state of decomposition. She was found to have a fractured right temple, a broken left ulna, the bone in the forearm, and her left arm was bruised. She also had many cuts to her hands and arms. Due to the level of decomposition, the pathologist was unable to determine the exact injury that caused Natalie's death. However, the injuries to Natalie's arms were determined to be defensive wounds. Natalie was protecting herself from multiple blows to the head. Her funeral was arranged to take place on the 4th of July. The family say this date was very important to them and they chose it specifically due to it being Independence Day. They wanted Natalie to have her own Independence Day. The family asked people to wear traditional black clothes, but to wear their favourite party shoes, to celebrate Natalie's life and her own love for shoes. Joanne says she barely slept the night before Natalie's funeral. She worried people wouldn't show up. But the streets were lined with people paying their respects, and the crematorium was filled with people saying goodbye to Natalie. Joanne read the following passage from a poem named "Feel No Guilt in Laughter." "Feel no guilt in laughter, she would know how much you care. Feel no sorrow in a smile that she's not here to share. For if you keep those moments, you will never be apart, and she will live forever, locked safely within your heart." Even though the evidence was piled high against Paul, on the 11th of July, he took to court in his second hearing, still denying that he murdered Natalie. However, months later, just before his trial was to begin, he decided to change his plea. He pleaded guilty to the manslaughter of Natalie, claiming that he threw an ornamental egg at Natalie's head in anger, which had killed her. The evidence and autopsy of Natalie's body suggested that she'd been struck multiple times, and so Paul's plea was declined, and the court continued to proceed with a conviction of murder.
This episode is sponsored by Elfster. It's almost that time of year and nothing crushes your Christmas spirit faster than the stress of organising gifts for everyone. Elfster is the number one Secret Santa app in the world. Elfster makes giving gifts easier by allowing you to create a free gift exchange. All you have to do is set the date and budget and Elfster will take care of the rest. They even draw the names for you. You can make wish lists to share with your family and friends to make sure that everyone gets the gift they really want.
You can add gifts to your wish list from your favourite brands like Amazon, Etsy, Fanatics, Nordstrom and more. You can also shop from curated gift guides. Elster is trusted by more than 17 million people to arrange their Secret Santa gift exchange. Go to elster.com or download the Elster app. It's E-L-F-S-T-E-R. Elster. The trial began on the 24th of October at Luton Crown Court. Prosecutor Simon Russell Flint told the court, "Natalie died at the hands of this defendant. This evidence that we gathered proves that she was struck brutally to the head by Mr. Hemming in the home that they shared. She was killed on May 1st this year, and whether or not she died instantly or immediately following that attack on her, what the defendant did was remove her body from their home, take it in his car, and dump her body in the woods near Chandler's Cross in Hertfordshire. It was there that Miss Hemming's body was much later found, very clearly and undoubtedly dead. The defendant struck and killed Natalie in the living room of their home. He did not contact emergency services, telephone 999 to ask for an ambulance, or paramedics to come to the house, or for the police to attend. Instead, he wrapped her up, naked as she was found, in a carpet, the carpet she would have been lying on, and was either carried or dragged out of the house in which their children were peacefully sleeping in their beds upstairs, and disposed of her body in the boot of his car. He then drove 30 miles and disposed her naked body in woodland. He then returned home and casually and glibly and convincingly proceeded to lie and lie and lie to everyone who asked. Natalie's family, Natalie's friends, his own family and friends, as to Natalie's whereabouts. All the while he pretended to be worried and concerned where she was and for her welfare. The morning after he had killed their mother and dumped her body in the woodland, he took the three children off to Wicksteed Zoo for what must have been a happy trip. He told police that Natalie had gone away to clear her head as she had been raped by a work colleague on Saturday, following a night out, and said to the police that he believed she had gone to stay with a friend in Hemel Hempstead. Despite the defendant's attempt to control her and to have her for himself, she had discovered that there was something beyond the world of Paul Hemming. Paul had then tried to cover his tracks by sending messages from Natalie's phone to himself and her family and friends. He also texted Simon, the man Natalie had been seeing, and said that they had decided to stay together. He took it further by telling Natalie's work that Simon had raped her. Paul Hemming testified in his own defence. He said he had threw a heavy ornamental egg which struck Natalie and caused her to fall on the corner of the coffee table. He claimed he then panicked when he realised she was dead, saying, "I couldn't believe I had done it. I just thought, shit, I'm in trouble. How am I going to explain to the kids upstairs? So then I thought, I'm going to cover this up." He wrapped Natalie's body up while his children were sleeping. He placed it into the car and drove 30 miles to a secluded woodland area. He then stripped her body nude and dragged her face down and left her under some trees. He claimed he was ashamed and confused. He said that he was panicked that he would lose her after her date with Simon Dennis. And when she said that she'd had enough, he began grappling her to stop her leaving and hit her with a Fabergé jade egg. Pathologist Dr. Olaf Bedrzecki said that due to the advanced level of decomposition on Natalie's body, it was impossible to determine her exact cause of death. She had a skull fracture by her right temple and her right arm was broken. There may also have been fractures to her larynx, which would indicate she had been strangled. A statement written by Natalie's mother was read by the prosecution. It said that Paul began accusing Natalie of having an affair on April 24th, and he would even press the issue in front of their children. Natalie told him that she was finished, and he agreed to help her rent somewhere to live, but then changed his mind. Natalie's mother asked him to keep it amicable, but he said it would never be amicable. Natalie's mother knew something was wrong when her daughter wasn't answering her phone after April 30th, and when she went to the house a few days later, seeing Natalie's car parked in front of Paul's made her anxious. Paul said it was because Natalie had a problem with the clutch in her car, a blatant lie, because Natalie drove an automatic. Rebecca Hornsby, Natalie's childhood best friend, testified that Natalie was planning on leaving Paul and told her she was sick of it. She told Rebecca that Paul was trying to change her mind, begging her, threatening her, and he even went for her, grabbing her arm and twisting it behind her back. Paul rang Rebecca following Natalie's disappearance and Rebecca recorded the calls. In the recordings, Paul said that he has no idea where Natalie is and that she was annoyed at him for not doing his fair share around the house and had left to clear her head. He also told Rebecca that Natalie said she was raped by Simon Dennis. Joanne, Natalie's sister, said that seeing Paul for the first time in court confirmed everything that Natalie used to say about Paul having two faces. He was no longer the happy, carefree man he presented himself as to everybody else. He now looked evil, cold, and calculating. The court heard a statement from an employee at Apple who had spoken to Natalie after she had taken her phone into the store. The phone had been locked out because somebody had attempted to access it with the wrong password numerous times, and the Apple employee also alerted Natalie to Find My iPhone, which had recently been enabled without her knowing. Despite Paul's insistence that Natalie's death was accidental, on the 4th of November the jury came to the unanimous decision that Paul was guilty of her murder. He was also charged with obstructing a coroner and preventing the burial of a body. He was sentenced to life in prison with a minimum of 20 years and will be eligible for parole on the 29th of October 2036. Presiding Judge Richard Foster said, "Natalie knew you were overbearing, controlling, jealous, and on occasion violent. You said you would mend your ways, and you did not. I have no doubt when she arrived home on Sunday afternoon you were in a state of high agitation and overcome by anger and jealousy. Once the children were in bed, a violent argument arose in the course of which you attacked her viciously to the head with some sort of implement. She attempted in vain to defend herself. Having murdered your partner of 10 years and the mother of your children, you proceeded in the most callous way to cover up what you had done. You stripped her naked and put her body in the boot of your car. You drove to a remote location and you dragged her through the undergrowth. It was not found for another 3 weeks. You then went on to tell lie after lie. The manner in which you have conducted yourself since the murder indicates a complete lack of remorse." As Paul's sentence was read out, Natalie's brother Sean mouthed, "You're going down," to Paul, and Paul mouthed back, "I don't care, I enjoyed every minute of it." Prosecutor Liz Scriven called Paul Hemming an extremely cold, callous, and calculated man. Detective Chief Inspector Simon Seal from the Thames Valley Police Major Crime Unit said that Paul Hemming had opportunities to admit what he had done to lessen the family's anguish, but he only admitted to killing her on the first day of his trial. Even then, he claimed it was manslaughter, which meant her family had to go through a painful trial.
"I'm Detective Chief Inspector Simon Steele, the Senior Investigating Officer for the murder of Natalie Hemming. Natalie was murdered on the 1st of May this year at her home address in Newton Leys, Milton Keynes, by her partner, Paul Hemming. Following the murder on the evening of Sunday, the 1st of May, Paul drove the body of Natalie to Woodland in Chandler's Cross, Hertfordshire, where he disposed of Natalie. For almost 3 weeks, Natalie was left there until she was found. The horror that her family had to go through, whereas Paul continued throughout that period of time to maintain his lies and that Natalie had simply left. And the following day, he even took the three children to what they felt was a family treat, and they went to a zoo. Up until the first day of these court proceedings, almost 6 months later, Paul has denied any involvement in her murder. On the first day of the court proceedings, Paul finally admitted to the unlawful killing of Natalie and disposing of her body in Woodland in Chandler's Cross, Hertfordshire. He, however, maintained his lies and would not fully admit his involvement and stated he was only guilty of her manslaughter. We welcome the decision of the jury, who saw through his lies and found him guilty of the murder of Natalie. I appreciate that domestic abuse can be very hard to spot. However, if you or you know of any others who are suffering mental, physical, or emotional abuse, please contact Thames Valley Police on 101 or 999.
After Natalie's disappearance, the children were forced to leave their homes with a single carrier bag of possessions. They had to leave everything behind. Natalie's eldest and youngest daughter moved in with Joanne, who already had four children of her own, and Natalie's son is now in the care of Kerry. Joanne and Kerry fundraised in the local area and many people generously donated money for clothing and furniture and toys for the little ones to play with. The families living on the estate where Natalie lived raised bundles of gifts to donate to the children too. Joanne says on her own YouTube channel that she feels very fortunate that her and Kerry received this support, because not every family will. She states that there isn't anywhere for people in their position to turn financially, and is fighting to change this. The family hope that the documentaries they have taken part in, Catching a Killer on Channel 4, When Missing Turns to Murder, and From the Eyes of a Child on BBC 2, will raise awareness about the dangers many people face when remaining within a domestically abusive relationship. They can't do anything to change what happened to Natalie, but they hope it changes the story of many other people. Their aim is for people to now be able to recognise the pattern of behaviours that occurred within Natalie and Paul's relationship before she was brutally murdered, and how dangerous coercive control within a relationship is. Joanne talks about how many people expect domestic abuse victims to be covered in bruises, when in reality, it runs much deeper than that. Natalie was a victim of physical, emotional, and financial abuse and was manipulated by Paul Daly to keep her under his control. He was unknowingly stalking her and making her believe that everything was her fault. Joanne regularly attends conferences to speak openly about the effects and signs of domestic abuse. She says, if telling her story can help another woman walk away from an abusive relationship, then we will know that my sister did not die in vain. Joanne also publicly supports the charity AAFDA, Advocacy After Fatal Domestic Abuse. She states that they are essential to families in this position, guiding them through all of the steps following the murder of a loved one as a result of domestic abuse, and making sure that grieving families are not left in the dark through the entire process. Natalie's eldest daughter, Kirsty, who is now 17, speaks openly about the effect that domestic abuse had on her as a child. She is a patron of Operation Encompass, which supports children who suffer abuse or live within an abusive household. She was also a domestic abuse ambassador at her school.
Over the course of their 9-year relationship, Natalie had called the police 3 times. She'd spoken to a domestic abuse helpline in 2013, telling them that Paul had hit her in the back of the head and had spat in her face and demanded that he could just kill her. In early 2020, authorities admit that they had failed to support Natalie and could have done more with the information they had available to prevent her death. Many times, people suffering abuse do not realise that they are being abused, and by the time they do, it's too late. Domestic abuse isn't always physical. It can be displayed in many ways, psychologically, financially, and sexually, as well as general harassment, online abuse, and coercive control. Coercive control is used as an intimidation tactic to change the normal behaviour and attitudes of somebody in an attempt to get them to behave how you want them to. In Natalie's case, Paul begged her to stay at home and did not want her to have the independence of getting a job. She had to hide texts regularly because he would check her phone at any given time, and he would attempt to isolate her from people she loved. He humiliated her by spitting in her face and would obsess of her every move. He also enabled spyware on her phone without her knowing so he could stalk her. Women's Aid provided a list of common examples of coercive control in their website. Isolating you from friends and family, depriving you of basic needs such as food, monitoring your time, monitoring you via online communication tools or spyware, taking control over aspects of your everyday life, such as where you can go, who you can see, what you can wear, and when you can sleep. Depriving you access to support services, such as medical services. Repeatedly putting you down, such as saying, you're worthless. Humiliating, degrading, or dehumanizing you. Controlling your finances. Making threats or intimidating you. To answer the question of why didn't she leave, research and statistics show that the risk of homicide in abusive relationships increases significantly when the victim tries to leave, with the perpetrator exerting their last attempt of control. In 2019, domestic homicide figures were the highest they had been in the UK in over 5 years. Dr. Jane Monckton Smith, a criminology expert, examined over 372 domestic homicides in the UK and noticed that they all followed a similar pattern. She created an 8-stage model to raise awareness of the risk of homicide in domestically abusive relationships and to prevent further deaths. Number 1. A pre-relationship history of stalking or abuse by the perpetrator. 2. The romance developing quickly into a serious relationship. 3. The relationship becoming dominated by coercive control. 4. A trigger to threaten the perpetrator's control. For example, the relationship ends or the perpetrator gets into financial difficulty. 5. Escalation. An increase of the intensity or frequency of the partner's control tactics, such as by stalking or threatening suicide. 6. The perpetrator has a change in thinking, choosing to move on either through revenge or by homicide. 7. Planning. The perpetrator might buy weapons or seek opportunities to get the victim alone. And 8. Homicide. The perpetrator kills his or her partner and potentially hurts other people, such as the victim's children. Natalie's relationship with Paul followed all of these stages. Paul had been abusive to previous partners. The relationship developed quickly and Natalie was dominated by coercive control. The relationship ended and Paul sought revenge. He waited until the children went to bed and she was on her own before killing her. A domestic homicide review found that there were signs of abuse in their relationship and that there had been a failure to explore and corroborate that information. Natalie had contacted police 3 times in 9 years and disclosed information which showed that she was in an abusive relationship. When she stopped engaging with the supports, they did not follow up and check in on her. If you or anyone you know are in a domestically abusive relationship, it is extremely important that you let somebody know if you are safe and able to do so. Natalie's family are hopeful that people will listen to Natalie's story and view it as an example of what can happen when people, the police and services are unaware of the exact position you are currently in. Natalie's death will not be in vain. Her story will save so many lives.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Crime Lapse. Crime Lapse is an independent podcast that is funded in part by our generous Patreon supporters. If you enjoy the show and want to help us keep it going, you can join us on patreon.com/crimelapse. In exchange for your pledge, you'll get access to early release ad-free episodes, bonus content, and exclusive merchandise. You can also support the show by subscribing and leaving us a 5-star review. You can keep up to date with us on social media at Crime Lapse on Instagram and Facebook, and at Crime Lapse Pod on Twitter. Stay safe. CrimeCon is coming back to London in 2022. Following the incredible reception to the first CrimeCon UK in September 2021, the event is back in the Leonardo Royal St. Paul's Hotel on June 11th and 12th, 2022. We'll be back on Podcast Row along with some incredible podcasts like They Walk Among Us, Mens Rea, Morbidology, and more. There'll be some fantastic speakers and interactive exhibits across the weekend too. The feedback from the people who were there in September has been great, so you do not want to miss the weekend. Most of those in attendance went on their own, but it didn't take long to make friends with like-minded people with an interest in true crime. Tickets are on sale now on the crimecon.co.uk website. Not only are the tickets at their lowest price at the moment, but you can get an extra 10% off when you use our code WINDOW. You can split the cost of the ticket into 3 installments to make it easier to afford, but the price includes 2 full days of content, access to talks, exhibitions, podcast row and more. Get your tickets now for the world's number one true crime event, CrimeCon UK 2022.
Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.